Hey, this is Vernon Reed, and you're listening to the Rock Solid Podcast with Pat Francis.
Make me a deal and make it good for me. I won't get full of myself, I can't afford to be. This is small town music, this is big town music. He's ahead of his time, you know, but he can't use it. If only he could prove it. Well, tomorrow's just a song away, a song away, a song away.
Hey everybody, welcome to Rock Solid, the comedy podcast for all things music, both new and classic. I'm Pat Francis, and joining me today in the Zoom room, you know him as the guitarist and songwriter from the band Living Color. He also has solo albums, and he's been doing this thing for, boy, about 40 years now, I guess.
Yeah, it's been a while.
Please welcome Vernon Reed. Hello, Vernon.
Hey, everybody. What's going on? You know, Mr. and Mrs. and Ms. America. And non-binary and all the ships at sea.
So, Vernon, where are you located? I'm in Los Angeles. Where are you right now?
I'm in Staten Island, New York, a.k.a. Shaolin, as dubbed by the Wu-Tang Clan. And you know, I only refer to it as Shaolin. And I'm in the North Shore of Staten Island, which is a very important distinction because people tend to think of Staten Island as one identity, you know, like a one kind of pro-Trump identity. And actually, you know, it's a lot more diverse than that. So I'm living in the blue section of a very red borough.
Excellent. So you got all your gear behind you. This is your recording room that I'm looking at.
This is the Dharma Lab. This is my audio man cave, if you will. And we've got amps here. There's a drum kit that I was gifted by Will Calhoun, the drummer from Living Color. Gave me one of his many drum kits, and I use it for when I'm doing rehearsals or doing recording and stuff down here too.
Now, is it a true gift, or are you just is he just storing it there? Is that yours forever, or do you have to give
it back?
Six
of one, half a dozen of the other. No, he's being a mensch. He's being a mensch.
Very nice. Let's mention the other members of Living Color. We have Corey Glover on vocals, and yes. Doug Wimbush on bass.
Yes, and Doug Wimbush on bass. Yes,
that's the current lineup. And
that's the current lineup. And of course, our dear friend Mud Skillings, we're all still friends.
I was going to ask that. I was going to ask when you part ways with someone, if you guys, because you started this band Living Color together, so you have a bond.
Well, actually, it actually is a crazy origin story. Like, I started the band in Good God Almighty 1984, and it went through a lot of different iterations. But the band that everybody knows became the band. Went through changes for the first few years, but the band that everybody knows really came together in 1986. So that's when Muzz and Will joined the band.
And then, when you start something like this, because you guys recorded the first album together, and Muzz is in the band, then you do have a bond with Muzz that you might not, you know, ever have with Doug, even though he's your buddy.
Well, he's a mate. We were friends. We were friends before. I mean, I was friends with Doug Wimbush before Living Color, and so he was around right when, because you know he was in his band Tackhead, and before Tackhead, he had a band called Fats Comet and the Big Sound, and he was working with the producer Adrian Sherwood. But he knew me, you know, back when they used to have a spot on 14th Street, and so he knew me right when I was starting the band that became Living Color and stuff like that. So, you know, it's a lot of different relationships and friendships going on a long time.
So it makes sense that when Muzz is no longer there, Doug naturally gets the call.
Yeah, it was a weird, you know, not going to tell tales out of school, but, you know, something like that is always, it's a rending, and it's always very painful. And, you know, and over time, a lot of those wounds have healed, you know.
Well, this show isn't about drama, and I'm just glad to hear that you guys are all still buddies. That's cool.
Yeah, man. Yeah, I love Muzz, you know.
How long have you been in Staten Island? Is that your home base? Has that been the home base for a long time?
I grew up in Brooklyn. I grew up in Brooklyn, a little bit in Bed-Stuy, but mainly in Crown Heights. And but I've been on Staten Island off and on since 1990. But I was married to my first wife, and then we divorced, and that was a process. And I lived in Manhattan over the length of our divorce. And divorce took about 3 years, you know. And then at the end of all of that, you know, she didn't want the house. And then I was either going to move back in or I was going to sell it.
Right.
And when I walked into the house was just neutral. You know, I was going to walk in. Either was going to be haunted.
Right.
Or was not going to be haunted. And if I walked in and I felt haunted, then I probably would have moved back to Brooklyn. But the house, it's a great Victorian house, and it was very neutral.
That's good.
And I decided to stay. I love it.
Excellent.
The abstract. It's named the Abstract Ranch.
You gave it a name.
Which the rapper Beans from Antipop Consortium, he dubbed it. He gave it that name. It's a crazy story. I used to have a stuffed two-headed calf that was lent to me by the painter Sam Messer. He was moving, and he said, "You want to hold on to my two-headed calf?" And I said, "Yeah." So it was in the house, and I also had a stuffed marlin on the porch, just kind of hanging on the porch. And one time, Beans came in, he looked around and said, "Man, this is like an abstract ranch." And I said, "That's it, bro."
I even
had a plaque made. Anyway,
I feel like your friends, when they don't want something at their place, they come and give it to you. Drums and a stuffed calf and a marlin. Tell your
marlin.
Friends.
I got the marlin. I got that marlin at a, you know, I wish I'd caught it myself, but you know, you don't get marlins unless you go down to Florida. You have to be, you know, fishing in Florida.
Yeah.
So I got it. There used to be a great antique flea market in New York that was on the weekends. That was right on 26th Street. And anyone that's an old New York head remembers there used to be an amazing flea market. I used to see Seymour Stein, the president, you know.
Of Sire Records.
President of Sire Records.
Yeah.
I used to see Seymour Stein I would see him all the time looking for antiques and things. That was a whole subculture.
Yeah,
so many dead subcultures in New York now.
I love, Seymour Stein, iconic. I love Sire Records. My God, the Ramones and Pretenders and Talking Heads. Yeah, I mean, you name it. So I have written down here, you were born in the UK.
I was born in London, in North London, at St. Mary's Hospital in Paddington. And I was born in the same hospital where Jimi Hendrix was declared dead.
Wow, that's given what you do.
Freaky.
Given what you do for a living, and your heritage, that's kind of interesting.
It's weird. It's just one of these weird coincidences. And part of it is, when I think about it, Jimi Hendrix, and I actually tweeted this. Like, it seems to me that Jimi Hendrix would have never become Jimi Hendrix if he didn't go to London with Chas Chandler,
mm-hmm.
and if my parents hadn't taken their infant son to New York, to America, I might not have become a guitarist at all. So it's a weird kind of flip.
It is.
You know, there are no patterns. Everything's kind of random. But if you look, you'll see weirdness.
Yeah.
The weirdness, the coincidences start to pop up. And that can freak you out.
It's also that's also the cool stuff, too, though.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah,
oh,
sure.
Yeah. And that's the great, one of the things I love to say is that some stories take a long time to tell. And a lot of times the weirdness, the irony, it'll take a generation or two because we're focused on what's happening in one lifetime. We're focused on, and then unless you expand the story out, then you don't see, and that person met that person, and then this happened, and then that happened, and then this happened.
Yeah.
And that's what makes life totally fascinating and really bizarre for good and ill.
Yeah, and you never know if that's just a freak coincidence or if those things are meant to be, like set in stone before. Who knows?
Well, that's the strange thing about time. Time fixes everything. Like, everything is possible. Like, everything is really is possible.
Yeah.
And then it gets fixed in time. Now, what changes it is your interpretation of events. So you can see an event one way, and then given enough time, you can turn around and see that same event exactly the opposite way you saw it before. The way it was experienced is one way, and then you go back and, you know what? That was actually concave. It wasn't convex at all, you know?
Even something that appears to be a tragedy years later can turn out to have been something good, or something good comes from it.
Well, that's part of the... You know what? I one of the things I thought, and there's no proof of this, but I actually think we landed a man on the moon, and one of the reasons we landed a man on the moon is because of Kennedy's assassination. I think that when Kennedy was assassinated, something, because he says, you know what? We're going to do the hard thing, and we're going to put a man on the moon by the end of the decade. And something, there's a part of me that thinks, you know, the engineers, they became weirdly dedicated to fulfilling that goal. You know, and that could just be, and who knows? And maybe if Kennedy had lived, there would have been budgetary fights. There would have been all kinds of things because of other things he wanted to do.
Right.
And it wouldn't have happened. And that's the, you know, it's a terrible event. And really, all of American history, a lot of what we're dealing with now with conspiracy theories, the conspiracy, I mean, it goes back before Kennedy, but in the modern era, the assassination of President Kennedy is the beginning of the whole idea of conspiracy in the modern age because of the Zapruder film.
Yep.
And what sealed the deal was the killing of Lee Harvey Oswald by Jack Ruby. And I was with my parents in Brooklyn, sitting between my parents, and I'll never forget, it was Walter Cronkite was saying, and that's the man that killed the president. And all of a sudden, you just see this fedora come into the frame.
Yeah.
And he shot him. Yeah. And it was complete chaos. And it was unbelievable because it was all live TV.
Yeah.
But that's the beginning. Those two events, you know, obviously the assassination of Kennedy, but then the removal of Lee Harvey Oswald. And I think we're still dealing with the effects of that big time.
And you mentioned Walter Cronkite. That's when the news was the news. You felt like you were getting the truth from one or two people. It wasn't spread all over the place with
trusted sources.
Trusted sources.
You know, there were very few channels. There were like four or five channels.
You know what I mean?
If you included your local TV station, but really nationally, there were three channels.
Yeah, NBC, ABC, CBS. That's it.
And Walter Cronkite had an unimpeachable reputation for veracity.
Right.
When he turned against the Vietnam War, Johnson said, I lost Cronkite. You know, he was like, that was when the public tide really shifted. Because, you know, they were sending journalists over there. And they were saying, you know what Westmoreland and them are saying? That's not what we're seeing at all.
No.
And there was this one fateful report. And it just kind of devastated the war effort. And it happened right at the time when the music was changing. And all of these things happened, again, in a kind of synchronous way.
Did you, let me ask you this. What were your parents doing over in the UK? Were they working there?
My parents were part of a wave of people. Because the British had colonies, you know, the sun never set on the British Empire, except the sun set on the British Empire basically in the 50s and the 60s. It really set. But, you know, it was people that were all over the Caribbean, from the English-speaking Caribbean, people from Pakistan and India, people from Nigeria, from the African colonies. They were all kind of intrigued to come to the UK to help rebuild.
Okay.
To rebuild the English cities, the UK, because basically they'd had the you know, they've been bombed to pieces.
Yeah.
And the rebuilding of the big industrial cities, that went on all through the 40s and into the 50s. And at one point, my mom worked as a welder. You know,
wow.
did spot welding. Yeah, you know, this is real Rosie the Riveter type stuff. You know,
so they were part of this rebuilding movement.
They were part of this rebuilding movement, and there was a lot of resentment that was thrown at them, because you know that's where the beginning of the, you know, England for the English. You know, this is a white man's country. You know, all of that kind of stuff. And what happened was there was a split. You know, there were some of the people from the Caribbean. My parents are from Montserrat. You know,
okay.
Small island near Antigua, and there was a split. You know, my father's sister stayed with my uncle Boston. He drove a double. He actually drove and retired as a double decker bus driver. And my parents, they took their chances on America, because that's when the beginning of the Teddy Boys and all that pre-National Front type of stuff, you know, was getting kind of hairy, you know, kind of violent and whatnot. And I was like a year old. And so they split. But it kind of parallels the Great Migration from the South to the Industrial North.
So they moved here, and you were born in 58, is that correct?
I was born in 58, and so, I was brought to the States like late 59. It was, I was one and a half. When I was, you know, so they were established in 1960.
Gotcha. But you weren't even old enough to remember living in London.
I can't even do a decent fake UK accent, which is incredibly frustrating to me that I was born, and I can't, you know what I mean. I can much more do a kind of Caribbean accent because I grew up around it.
Yeah,
But the UK accent, I cannot do at all. I can't do it at all. I can't. It's terrible. If I tried to do, I sound horrible. You know, it's one of the bitter ironies of my life.
So your parents,
Brooklyn accent.
Yeah, you can definitely do that, I'm sure. The
Brooklyn boy.
So your folks, they must have been saving their money while they're working these jobs at rebuilding, so that they had money to come to New York, because, you know,
absolutely,
New York is no cheap place to live in any era. And what was was the upbringing like in New York when you came here? When did you start
to realize it? I lived in an apartment.
Mm-hmm.
We had an apartment. It was a one or two bedroom apartment on St. Mark's Avenue. I mean, that's how I learned to ride a bike. I learned to ride a bike inside the apartment, and it was basically taking the bike and going in a straight line to the opposite wall, and left tire marks in the wall, because, you know. But that's what, you know, it was like, they wouldn't let me. I had to learn how to balance in the apartment before I could take a bike out on the street.
Well, it's nice that they bought you a bike and let you ride it inside. A lot of folks wouldn't let you do that.
Yeah, it was pretty weird. It was pretty weird stuff. But you know, one of the things I remember, man, was the, you know, TV. I remember watching black and white TV. I remember also our record player, because before they had like kind of portable record players, they had like, it was like a gigantic piece of furniture.
Yeah, a piece of furniture,
it was like radio. It had a top. You know, you had to bring the top up.
You could stack the albums up there, or the records, whatever they were, and they would fall on top of each other. Yeah.
Absolutely.
I know it.
They even had like a little thing where you could lean the albums up. It was very pretty practical, right? You could lean them all up, and you lean them up in the order that you were going to play them.
Yep.
Yeah. So there was always music around. And you know, my parents, you know, liked a lot of different kinds of music, and they loved, you know, American R&B music. And so, you know, James Brown was like, you know, all of those sounds. But also, they were still liked music from England. You know, like mom was like, she liked the Dave Clark Five. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I remember when the Beatles came on the Ed Sullivan Show. So it was a different context of hearing the Beatles. Like, they were like the lads from Liverpool, right? So my parents still had a certain amount of affection. Even though they, you know, they had to split, they still had a certain, you know, amount of affection. You know, like they loved Queen Elizabeth. She was cool. You know what I mean, to them. You know, so it was, you know, they just couldn't deal with the, you know, the kind of hooligans.
Right.
That was the thing. But music, you know, AM radio, records, all kind of records, you know, the Stax records, but also hearing all the Calypso records like the Mighty Sparrow, Lord Melody, you know, the Ska records, the Scatolites, some of the very, very early reggae records, you know. So there was a lot of different, it was a very wide open musical environment.
Eclectic.
So very eclectic. And the other great thing was I was never told how I should feel about whatever it was I was listening to. Mm-hmm. I was never told, don't listen to this, listen to that. Mm-hmm. I was never told those things. So I made my own judgments about the sounds I heard. So, you know, like the first time I heard Dionne Warwick, I fell in love. I thought she was the greatest singer in the world.
Yeah.
You know, singing all that stuff, you know, Aretha Franklin, you know, Gladys Knight, like all of these vocalists that I heard, you know, and also Sam Cooke and, you know, Al Green. My youngest aunt was... Al Green was it. Al Green, she actually went and saw him. He played at the Beacon Theater. I remember that her and her girlfriend, you couldn't tell her nothing. She had every Al Green album. Huge fan.
That was
my mother's
sister. It sounds like because of your parents' eclectic taste, there was no, when it came to music, there was no black or white. It was everything. You were introduced to every type of music.
Yeah. There was no kind of, there was never, oh, that's white people's music.
Right.
That didn't happen. Mm-hmm. It was like, it was, because naturally we gravitated R&B and, you know, dance music and then it became funk. Oh, that was all in the mix. But like the Beatles, you know, we love the Beatles.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
My cousin's mom was a huge Elvis fan.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like she had like a blue Hawaii record. You know what I mean? She was, you know, it was like stuff nice. Like that. So it wasn't like, so in a way I was free to form my own opinions about what was good and what I liked and what I didn't like.
Yeah. Well, my upbringing is I grew up in a small town in Western Pennsylvania, about 5,000 people. And sad mm-hmm. to say, I wasn't really exposed to black people until I moved to Chicago in my 20s.
That must have been quite a shock.
It's
Chicago.
It just made me feel, it made me feel sad and it made me feel a little mad, but it wasn't, it was just where I lived. They're just, I mean, I'm sure there were black people around, but I mean, I can tell you if you go through my high school yearbook, you'll find one kid. And when I see that picture, I think, what was it like for that one kid? It must've been,
not good.
Super
not
strange.
Great.
Not because, great.
Not great because for everyone that was cool, there were five that were not cool.
Absolutely.
Or there was gaslighting, or there was weird
Absolutely.
Stuff that went on. Right. Like people forget about Jackie Robinson and the Outfield. I mean, it's kind of funny because you say to yourself, well, where did all those people that, you know, called them the N-word? Where did they all go? And when did their attitudes exactly change?
Right.
You know what I mean? And when did they stop telling their kids that was okay? Like,
right.
It was never okay to subject him to that.
No.
Right?
No.
And the fact, you know, and so basically, the attitudes change when either people, some people do have a change of heart, which is very rare. If they have a kind of moral compass that at least informs them that, you know what, this is enough.
Yeah.
Enough of this, right? That happens, of course, but that's not a mass movement.
Yeah.
And also, it happens when children defy their parents and say, you know what, I reject your values. And that's why the battleground of education is so, that's why it's so intense. That's why the busing, and you know, like a lot of stuff that went on, people think of the South.
Yeah.
You know, they think about what happened in the South.
Mm-hmm.
But out in New York, Queens, busing in Queens was like, it was not a game. Like, people were, I mean, it was shameful the way people acted. The way people acted in Boston, there's that famous photograph of a guy being stabbed by this angry white guy with an American flag. You know, I mean, and that's, we're dealing with the legacy of all of these things that have gone on for a really long time. And the idea of really being able to face one another and speak honestly to one another about our experiences.
Yeah.
You know, that's part of a difficult, long process. That's
right.
Why, you know, we're a quarter way into the 21st century practically.
Yeah.
And we're still dealing with things that we kind of thought we dealt with some of this stuff in the 70s or in the 80s mm-hmm. or in the 90s. And it turns out that we didn't.
Yeah. And
we didn't at all.
Yeah. I mean, we 5 years ago or so, you know, you always think things are getting better. And then you realize, oh, no, here we are again. It's
they are getting better, but the pace is glacial.
Yeah.
And it's like, you know, it's what is that thing? Three steps forward, six steps back. You mm-hmm. know, you go, you have seen advance, and then, you know, because the idea of dominance is a difficult thing to let go of.
Right.
I mean, we see this. See, white and black makes it very stark.
Yeah.
But around the world, there are ethnic conflicts. There are conflicts that are sort of like it's not about race per se.
Right.
It can be tribal. You know, it can be. It's like part of the one of the things that's weird is like the idea of whiteness. Whiteness is a construct like blackness.
Yeah.
You know, Europeans don't. You know, I mean, the idea of whiteness as a unifying thing. It's weird because then you have to ask yourself, who's white then?
Yeah.
Where do the Spaniards fit in? There's a hierarchy.
Right.
Where do the Italian?
Uh-huh.
Where do the Irish? Where
yep.
do the Norwegians, the Danish?
Yeah,
you know,
it's more gray. It's not black and white. It's
much more gray.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, and it's the same. It's the same deal. You know, like all over in the Bronx. You know, there are these couples. They're very interesting because you have people who are, you know, Will Calhoun, our drummer, is from the Bronx, mm-hmm. right? And one of the most interesting things about the Bronx is that there are a lot of mixed families, and they're mixed because like the families are half Jamaican and half American Southern.
Yeah.
So like the father is from a Jamaican background and the wife is from North Carolina. And the in-laws, when they get together, I mean, they're sharing food, but there's attitudes, right?
Sure.
Like some people are like, it's kind of like somebody that's Catholic marries a Protestant. And when the people get together, you think they're coming together, but it's weird,
yeah,
right?
They're
it's weird.
They're
the
coming
Irish,
together
I mean,
to argue. Yeah.
They're coming together to argue.
Yeah.
And that's why it's so funny. We get so caught up as if the conflict is solely about black and white. Well, that's like the most surface conflict. I mean, and the one thing is the fantasy that if you remove one people from the equation that there's going to be peace and harmony is a joke.
Yeah.
It's a joke. Think about the Irish. The Irish have been murdering each other.
Yeah.
The Hibernians have been murdering each other over religious differences mm-hmm. forever. They only sorted that out.
Right.
Like, what, 10 years ago? 10 years
yeah.
ago? And I mean, and we're talking about horrific, I mean, like blowing up buses of school children type of stuff. Like really
it's horrific.
Horrific stuff. And anyway, blah, blah, blah. Woof, woof, woof.
To start getting into the music here, I will tell you.
Yes.
So that was my upbringing, but then here's the deal: my parents raised me right, and mm-hmm. I can remember for Christmas one year, my favorite band then. Well, I loved the Jackson 5,
mm-hmm.
and you know I would, and then the year I wanted a G.I. Joe, I wanted a black G.I. Joe.
Mm-hmm.
And my parents, they couldn't just go get it in my hometown. They had to order it. It's Sears catalog. And I don't know if there was a comedian, Willie Tyler and Lester, and he had a...
Oh, yeah, right. Willie Tyler and Lester.
Yeah, he was
course.
A ventriloquist. I also wanted the Lester doll, and these things were all
That's
under our
so
tree
funny.
At Christmas. I know, and it's so fun. It's so funny to me. But here's my preconceived then notions. When Living Color comes out and I first see you guys, it's the first time. I mean, Jimi Hendrix rocked, and you know, Prince would rock at times, but you guys really broke down a thing where we see, you know, an entire African-American band that's a hard rock band. And I'm sure there's other bands like that out there, but you guys were the first that I saw. And you guys, I'm sure you didn't set out to break down any music walls. You guys were just doing what you did.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
But man,
it was refreshing. Well, thank you. You know, we just wanted to do what we wanted to do. I mean, that's the thing about it. One of the things that was so crazy was, like, you know, we had gotten to the point, we were local band in New York. We played the CBGBs, and I give Hilly Crystal, rest in peace, you know, he was wonderful to us, you know, and we got to a point, I mean, we went from the club being empty to, like, every time we played, it would be packed. And this is right at the time when the A&R people would come, and they, of course, the band, local bands, got a following.
Yeah.
That's in the natural order of things. That's how bands got signed. And we would come up against this thing, which was, well, how are we going to market it? We had a lot of disappointment and rejection. And it was really up to the point where Mick Jagger and Jeff Beck, you know, came by, you know, and Doug was working with them and a few other folks, you know, who were around. Mick said, man, you really should hear this guy's band, because I actually went an audition to play on Primitive Cool.
Yeah, and you do play on that. You do play some sessions.
I do play on that. And he said, and my audition was not great. Anyway, he says to me,
but he had seen you play. He had seen you play live. So
he came to see me play. He said, I was recommended. See, because it was like a cattle call. So every guitar player in New York, is coming, and the vibes. Trust the vibes were strange. Like, it was like bunch of young guys, and this is their shot. And it was all like that. So, you know, I went, and actually Corey Glover, Corey came with me to the audition. And, you know, at the end of the audition, you know, Mick says, man, I've heard your band is quite good. I'm going to come see your band play. And I was like, yeah, man, sure.
I was going to say, when Mick Jagger says that, you have to think, well, that's nice of you to say, but I doubt that's going to happen.
Yeah, you know what I mean? It's like, no.
It's Mick Jagger.
Whatever, you know. And so, when Hilly's son ran up to me and said, "You know who's here? You know who's here? It's Mick Jagger." And immediately I put it out of my mind.
Good.
I put it out of my mind
because it can mess with you.
I put it out of my mind and I didn't tell the guys.
Oh, nice. Good job.
Like, I'm in that that moment, it was, I knew if I took in the information, if I told the guys this, it would have destroyed the performance.
Yeah,
it would have been,
it would have fucked it up.
It would have totally fucked it up.
Yeah.
And so this was, there are little moments where I'll have a moment of insight. And this is one of these rare moments where, you know, knowing myself, like, I can be prone to anxiety. I can become very self-conscious. It's weird because I love playing. I love being on stage, but I also have this flip. I have this polarity flip where I'm going, what the hell am I doing here? You know what I mean? I can go back and forth.
Yeah.
And I was just very fortunate. And I literally forgot. I put it on myself. He said to me, I said, oh, that's some bullshit. I pushed it away. I said, no. And it was to the point where when we got off the stage, I'd really forgotten. And then one of our men said, man, Mick Jagger says, oh, what? Oh, yeah.
That's right.
It was almost like one of these kind of a meditation. It was almost like went into a state to, I knew it was going to mess with me. But the fact that, but it took.
And the show went great. You guys had a great show that night.
Yeah.
You guys killed it.
Yeah, it was great. Okay, it was great. We were just unselfconscious. We were in front of our crowd, making our moves, and it was just a good night.
Excellent.
It was just a good night.
Good. I want to interject. This is interesting to me. You're born in England. Your parents enjoy the English music. You come over here, and then it takes an icon from England to kind of push it's you guys weird. Push you guys into the forefront. And I assume Mick was instrumental in helping you guys get a deal.
He produced two of the songs.
Right.
The
yes. Glamour and Boys just, and Which and, Way to
which
America.
Which Way to America.
Yeah,
yeah, and we met Ed Stasium because anyway, I would go to play Primitive on the Primitive Cool,
and Ed Stasium's working on that album.
Met Ed Stasium was the engineer.
Yes. Okay.
For the album overall, and he was a very friendly guy, very warm guy. Just and we got to talking, and I said, "Man, I'm I like a lot of weird shit." There was these bands, and I was mentioning these kind of underground. Kind of rock, underground R&B, quasi rock bands, black rock bands, and I mentioned Mother Night, and I mentioned Automatic Man, and then I mentioned the Skull Snaps, and Ed Stasium looked at me and he said, "Oh, that was my first job."
Wow.
I was like,
that's strange.
I was like, what? He said, yeah, Skull Snaps. They're from Newark, New Jersey. That was my first gig. And then I said, you're hired. Like, in my mind, I was like, because we were interviewing different people. But when he said that he had worked with the Skull Snaps, it was such a weird coincidence that I was like, I got to work with
this
guy.
Yeah, you got it. That was one of my questions. I didn't know if the label puts you together with Ed Stasium, but you guys chose him, so that's cool.
Yeah. Yeah, well, we're meeting people, and we're talking about different people. And at one point, at one point, Phil Ramone used to come to our gigs. So at one point, Phil Ramone really wanted to produce us, like Gary Katz, and expressed interest. So there were
now, this is
really
just for people that don't know, Phil Ramone is best known for working with Billy Joel, all the classic Billy Joel albums, and Gary Katz is with Steely Dan.
Steely Dan,
those two, Living Color with those two guys, that would have been unique, but I feel like Ed Stasium gets the rawness out of you guys on those
totally
records.
Got it.
Yeah, he gets it.
This is where I come from. I call this place my home. You call this place.
And it was just, and it was like, it was kind of like, so there were all these, and these were people whose work I, and I loved Phil. Phil's a lovely person too.
Absolutely. Both and, great guys.
But the thing about it, that coincidence was so like a bolt from the, it was like a message.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And was like, oh, it was, that was, it was crazy. And so, that's, and I think we made a really good choice because it's those connections that really matter. It's those human weird connections mm-hmm. that matter more than the famous names and the blah, blah, blah. And the, yeah. you know what I mean? Like you have to have this, you have to have this other thing. And I think a lot of times when you hear about things, everything that we dig, that's cool. Records, movies, plays
yeah.
are a compendium of happy accidents and weird coincidences.
Yeah.
Because you think about a movie, everything can go wrong with the movie. Everything can go wrong.
Yeah.
Like everything, right? So, and think about Apocalypse Now. Everything did go wrong. Everything went wrong with Apocalypse Now.
And yet,
terrible.
And yet,
right? And yet, it's a classic.
Yeah.
And yet, it's a classic. I mean, this is a, it's, and that's how I feel about so many things. Like a lot of times our industries, they sell us on the idea, you have all the proper credentials, you went to the proper schools, you're this and you're that, you have all these credits. But you know, one of the crazy things is that you could see a movie with your favorite actor that completely sucks.
And it's,
the director
yeah, it happens.
Could be a genius.
Yeah.
Right. You know, all of those things. And just like, you know, when something is cool, all the happy accents, all the coincidences, all those things line up along with the skills of the people and their yeah. training. That's all part of it.
Well,
right?
as a music fan, you know, my favorite band can release a new album and sometimes I might not like it.
Yeah.
But man. That the band's not trying to make an album I don't like. They're trying to make an album that they love and hoping yeah. their fans love. And sometimes it doesn't gel, but... Yeah,
it's weird. The Muse, the thing is just, it's one of the fact that we can't control it, right?
Yeah.
Just like comedy. Just like everything is the same thing. Like, you know, like a comedian go up and everything is just funny. And they could be doing bits or they could be doing jokes or they could be telling stories.
Yeah.
Or they could be, you know, and it can just be funny, just funny. That same comedian in a different town
yep.
can bomb monstrously. Bomb. It's just.
It could be an early show is amazing, and then the late show is terrible with the same vibe and same material, same guy, but you just never know.
And the thing is, part of the thing, we're at most risk when we're cool. The next thing, we have to be careful because we have to let go. Everything.
Yeah.
Right. So if you're on tour and everyone is syncing up and it's great, you cannot assume that the next show is going to be great.
Yeah.
That is murder. You have got to let go. You got to let go of sucking. Right. Like you, cause that can drag you down
yeah.
for a week. Right. So you missed the cue. You solo sucked. You got da da da. You didn't, whatever. You got to let that go.
Mm-hmm.
Make your adjustments, whatever you need to do. And then move on to the next thing. And if you play like a god, if you're as funny as Richard Pryor and Jackie Gleason and Red Skelton and all the, and you just, every syllable is just, you got yeah. to let that go completely. Because right. the next thing, I've seen it. I remember I was in a two-night stand and one of the musicians, I won't even mention the instrument, but they went up and they played this one, and it was like the heavens opened up. Every note this dude played was just, it was phenomenal. It was phenomenal. Crowd goes nuts, right? The next night, he started to try to do the same moves, and everything, it didn't happen at all.
So the first night, it was just flowing, and he was improviser, doing whatever he was doing. And the next yeah. night, he tried to do that, and nothing. Okay.
It happens with classical music. Like, you know, one of the best and worst pieces of music is Rhapsody in Blue.
Yeah.
Like Rhapsody in Blue, if the orchestra doesn't like jazz, it's the worst. It's corny and whack. It's whack. Yeah. You know what I mean?
I get
because,
it.
Because you know what I mean? Yeah. Rhapsody in Blue is the piece of blue. If you have an orchestra that, you know, at least half the people can swing and they can feel it, it's a magnificent piece of music. It's magnificent. Like all that stuff, when it's in sync and swinging, it's incredible. That those same notes.
Yeah. That's why.
My God.
That's why when bands do cover songs, it's tough because it's not going to be the original, but you better step it up and make it something new or try to.
You have to have your own way in. Like, if you're going to cover something, then those words have to mean something to you.
Yeah.
They have to. And they can't just be an excuse to blow over.
Yeah.
It has to mean something to you. And that meaning something to you, that, you know, it's a challenge because if it means something to you, it's got to be something that's close to the bone. Because other than that, you know, and you know, a lot of times music is, you know, it's not supposed to be transcendent, right? It's like, you know, it's just a tune on any given night. But, you know, at the same time, music, there's nothing like music.
No.
There's nothing like it. There's something, music will bring tears to your eyes. Music will mess you up. That's the point. When you hear that particular singer singing that particular song and you get it, you know, I mean, and it can be all the emotions, right? But it's kind of like, especially when you hear a singer, an artist at a certain point in their life, you get it. It's like listening to the Pretenders, right?
Love the Pretenders.
I love them.
Chrissy's my favorite vocalist.
I know Chrissy Hynde a bit. You know, I've met her a couple times. She's a pistol.
Nonsense there.
Oh, but you know, it's kind of like the classic records, you know, when James Honeyman Scott, you know.
Yeah, first two albums.
I mean, it's one of the great losses. He was, you know, he was a great, great. He was like right between Andy Summers and Jeff Beck.
Yeah.
Like right in between. It was great.
And Chrissy credits him for coming up with the sound of the band. She credits him all the time. Yeah.
And, but you know, when she did Learn to Crawl, that record, you know, like that record is great. And part of the reason why that record is great, like middle of the road, you know, that it's like you feel, and this is a person singing about their actual life. This is like actual life that this person's talking about.
Yeah.
You know, and that's what we want from our artists. You know, like one of the great tragedies to me is, you know, the fact that Whitney Houston never made the record. Like the whole pop thing destroyed her to me. And
like she never leaned into her roots.
And she never, you know, she never, I mean,
the way she could have, as strongly as she could have.
You know, like it's kind of like I remember thinking when Amy Winehouse did Rehab, I said, man, I wish that Whitney Houston had covered Rehab.
Yeah.
Because if Whitney Houston had done Rehab, that shit would have been like, it would have been so raw and so real. that would have been amazing. You know, what if she had come out and said, you know, me and Robin have this thing. What if she'd have, you know, maybe she'd have done something like what Frank Ocean did with Thinking About You. Maybe she could have did that, you know, a bunch. And you know, people's jaws would have been tight for about 5 minutes. But if she came out and sang her truth, everybody would have embraced it. I believe that. And it's a shame, you know, when, you know, this thing eats people, you know, eats people alive. It does. It ate her alive. And she was like,
Are you talking about
it ate her alive and ate Kurt Cobain alive. They were two people, opposite ends of the spectrum.
Yeah.
But they were voices of their respective generations.
And when you say eats them alive, do you mean the industry or drugs?
Yes. I mean the industry, which leads to self-medication.
Okay.
And you know, the pressure of, you know, of living a life that's not 100%. That's not 100% true. Not 100% real. I think part of the thing is like, Kurt Cobain was at risk because, you know, he had suicide in his family.
Yeah.
He had suicide ideation was in his family. And when Nirvana became so massive, you know, he came out of a scene that was very, you know, very close and whatnot. And all of a sudden, this guy becomes the thing. And then people are like, well, you know, oh, well, Mr. Rockstar. And it's like, oh, my God, that's not what he wanted at all.
No, he didn't want to be a rock star. He just wanted to.
He didn't want to be like, he wanted his records to do well. Of course.
Everyone does.
But a phenomenon like that, that's crazy.
He would have been much better being in the middle of that pack.
Absolutely.
Than at the forefront. Vernon, let me ask you, how have you been able to stay away from the things we've been talking about, medicating yourself and stuff?
For me, it's kind of funny because the fame thing, it happened to me. My main thing is music. You know, I've always been, you know, I've been kind of a science.
That's the drug.
Sci-fi nerd.
Yeah. I see Spock behind you. I see Mr. Spock behind you.
Yeah. My sister got me that, you know, because nice. I'm like an original crew Star Trek fan.
Right.
And Next Gen and a whole bit, you know. I'm a science fiction was big for me, you know. So that science fiction and comic books was all part of my thing.
Well, I knew that early in the conversation because you referred to the greater being as the engineers. And I love it. And I picked up on that. I heard that as soon as you said that, I'm like, okay, I'm enjoying this.
Well, you know what? One thing that defined a lot of my generation of people was the Twilight Zone. The Twilight Zone was so pivotal. I mean, and now Black Mirror is great because Black Mirror is kind of doing what Twilight Zone did.
Yeah.
But that black and white, the half hour Twilight Zone, because they tried an hour and it was too much. Half hour Twilight Zones with Rod Serling, with like Richard Matheson. Holy shit. I still get chills. That little guitar pitch, it still freaks me the F out because it would be so scary, but it would be so compelling and so well done. It was weird because it was my favorite show and it terrified me.
And when the Twilight Zone episode was over, it really wasn't over because it kept you thinking.
It kept you thinking. That, you know, like It's a Good Life, Billy Mummy, where he's just a kid and he can make anything happen.
Yeah.
That shit, you know, there would be these kind of moral lessons and these weird flips. Like the thing with where the woman is, she's seeing all these doctors and they're talking about her and saying, well, what can we do for her? Well, I don't know, man. How's she going to live like that?
You know
what I mean? Blah, blah, blah. And they will move away and she's beautiful, but their faces are all weirdly distorted.
Yeah, everyone else is the ugly people. Yeah. It's cool.
Right. And they're, you know, well, she'll have to live somehow, you know?
Well, I cut you off with the drug question. You were basically saying I guess that the music is your, that's the high.
Because you know, I was around, you know, a lot of, I was in bands. I'm not a Pollyanna about it, you know, I don't care what people do, but one thing, you know, I've seen some bad shit go down, you know, with friends. I knew people that were on the retail side that got messed up. And, you know, it's just, it's rough, you know?
Yeah.
You know, I've seen some rough things. I've seen some very sad and rough things happen. And because I managed to, I just managed to skirt it. Even though now I'm looking for a legit source for mushrooms. Definitely, I'm looking for legit shroom. You know, Michael Pollan is completely convinced me that it's time to storm the doorways of perception.
Is the lockdown making you think of these things?
Absolutely.
Can you believe that the song "Cult of Personality" is as relevant in 2020 as it was when you guys recorded it?
the cult of personality. I know your anger, I know your dreams. I've been everything you wanna be. Oh, I'm the cult of personality. Like Mussolini and Kennedy. I'm the cult of personality, the cult of personality, the cult of personality.
Well, it's such a, it's weird because I feel like this is the 30th anniversary of Time's Up.
Yeah.
And, you know, Vivid before that. And what's so strange, it's disturbing, and at the same time, you know, a lot of the things we said are very relevant. And Cult of Personality, I mean, it was kind of weird because it's like, what is it about? Why do we follow this person? Why do we, you know, why did people drink the Kool-Aid? Because Jim Jones, of course, he had dudes with guns making people do it. But why did people, you know, it's kind of like, why does that happen? You know, because that whole like impulse like to be a part of something greater than oneself, you know, that's a very dangerous thing. It's great, you know.
Yeah.
But it's also, you know, it's also, it can turn out not great. And now that personality and that whole idea of Warhol talked about, you know, being famous for 15 minutes. Well, that's accelerated. All of it's accelerated. You know, like all these things, you know, those are the things that made me think about the cult of personality. You know, and I'm a Cold War, you know, I mean, the end of the Cold War, right?
Yeah.
And Khrushchev banging his shoe at the UN, you know, that whole thing. But Khrushchev, you know, the most important thing that he did was denouncing Stalin because, you know, because the country was still under the grip. And he said, Stalin, you know, he ruled this country with a cult of personality. And that just, that phrase stuck with me. And I thought about, like, you know, I was thought about Mussolini, Kennedy, you know, just like the Camelot, the whole thing. It's you know, I think about the fact that, you know, Malcolm X and Martin Luther King, very important civil rights leaders who also look like movie stars. They look like Matt. That's you can't re, I mean, you can just hear their words, but the fact that they're both glamorous, and Angela Davis in her prime was also glamorous, that was part of their appeal. The fact that Che Guevara looked cool in his beret. The fact that Che Guevara looked cool, you know, he's on a 1,000 t-shirts, you know.
And Barack and Michelle Obama.
That 1,000-watt smile.
Yeah,
absolutely.
They're
not exempt. And that's the thing. Like, that, you know, that Shepherd's Ferry portrait of him, you know, that solidified it, you know. And he still got that 1,000-watt smile. You know what I mean? He's trim. You know what I mean? He's ready to go.
Like, when you want to stay a rock star, you got to be like Mick Jagger. You got to stay thin and you got to keep your hair. And Barack Obama has that rock star stuff. Charisma.
All you got to do, basically.
You can't buy charisma.
You can't buy it.
You got to have it.
You have it or you don't have it. Bowie had it, man. You know, I mean, that, like, Bowie had it. And it's funny. Like, I think about Steve Winwood. Steve Winwood is amazing.
Yeah.
Steve Winwood is great. And Steve Winwood has got an appeal, but he doesn't have the charisma of Bono.
No. No.
You know? And in fact, the Bono, he infuriates people. People are, they can't stand, they hate his guts. Or they're in his thrall. You know, it's just kind of, you know, because partly the thing is that Steve Winwood is an excellent musician. He's a great singer. He's one of my favorites, you know, and I love Traffic. Traffic is just
Spencer Davis. Spencer Davis group. I mean, yeah, all that stuff. I mean, before he had his 80s success, like, that's the thing about someone like a Steve Winwood. People think, oh, look at this. Who's this new guy? But it's like, no, he's not a new guy.
No.
He's been here forever.
Right. It's so funny because he was also, he was known as Little Stevie Winwood because he was very, very young. Mm-hmm. He was very young. It was my secret. I always wished that Stevie Winwood and Stevie Wonder would have done something. They both, their initials are both SW, you know.
They still could though, right?
They still could. It would be so great. I think their voices would blend phenomenally well. They're both phenomenal players, phenomenal singers. It would be, you know, and it's probably just one of those things. Because we think that in famous land, in the land of celebrity, that everybody knows everybody.
Right.
That's really not the case. And, you know, in certain collaborations, just they don't happen because they don't.
Right.
They just don't.
Maybe you need to put this together.
Oh, man. I've been trying to get Steve Vai and Tom Waits to do a project together. For the longest time. Every time I see Steve Vai, I say, you know, man, you got to do that. Because we were on the Experience Hendrix tour, right? Mm-hmm. And a bunch of guitar players playing Hendrix's music, Billy Cox, it was fantastic. And we were on the same bus, right? Mm-hmm. We were on the same bus, Living Color and Steve and a couple other people, you know. And at one point, he just said, man, I'm a huge Tom Waits fan. I looked at him and said, oh, you have to do a record with Tom Waits.
Right.
And he was like, that's, and I was like, you know, because, hey, man, he played on this Public Image Limited record. You know, he played on that record album, and it was amazing. So I'm just thinking, imagine.
Yeah, the time is now. No one's getting younger.
And you know what? I know. And just imagine Tom Waits, like Bone Machine era Tom Waits with mm-hmm. Steve Vai guitar. It's insane. It's insane. You know, so every time I see Steve, I always say, yo, man, you got to do that Tom Waits record, man.
Now, guitarists like you and Steve Vai, you guys are, you're touring, you're on this tour together. When you're watching him, you're amazed by his playing. And then when he's watching you, he's amazed by what you're doing. And yet you can learn from each other, but you can never do exactly what he does and vice versa.
Yeah. Well, that's the point. We all have to do. The thing that's so funny is to me is it's so important to be yourself. Like, you have to do yourself and to have a context for who you are. And, you know, Hendrix, the thing that makes him so astonishing, because you have to think about who he was in 67, 68, 69, and 70. He did all of that.
Yeah.
67, 68, 69, 70.
In a short period of time.
And it's like, think about something like Machine Gun. There hasn't been anything like that. Like, that version on the Band of Gypsies record, when you think about the Vietnam War and the fact that Jimmy was a veteran and his father fought in World War II, and the way he connects to veterans, he's, you know, Hendrix is revered by veterans because he, and even though he was considered a hippie avatar, it was weird, he was very ambivalent about the hippie thing, and you hear it in his music. If Six Was Nine, if all the hippies cut up all their hair, I don't care, right? His music is also, for all the psychedelic stuff, his music has a hard edge of reality. Like Castles Made of Sand is for me his greatest lyric. It's going in Castles Made of Sand, you know, fall into the sea eventually. It's astonishing.
And that's the thing.
And Machine.
When you think of Jimi Hendrix, you first think of the guitar, and then sometimes you don't think he was writing these words too.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
Incredible. The Wind Cries Mary is, oh my God, it's astonishing. It's an astonishing song. And the thing about it is that he was very influenced by Bob Dylan, but his being influenced by Bob Dylan didn't lead to him cloning, but it was just an influence.
Right.
So he had his own, I mean, that's why he covered All Along the Watchtower, because it's such admiration for Bob Dylan.
There must be some kind of way out of here. Say the joker to the thief. There's too much confusion. I can't get no relief. Businessman there to drink my wine. Plowman dig my earth. None will
nobody up in this world.
It's one case where one artist took the living influence of another artist and created this amazing body of work completely on his own. So the thing about all of that to say is that it's so important to create, to have a context for whatever it is that you're doing, whatever craziness you're doing, for whatever a context. Living Color was, in a lot of ways, my context for the guitar playing that I was doing.
Gotcha.
That I do. And it lives inside of tunes like Cult of Personality and Middleman and Open Letter to a Landlord and Broken Hearts. Because, you know, I think about the things that influenced me, like bands like Sly and the Family Stone and Led Zeppelin and to a degree The Police, just in its instrumentation. Mm. And the fact that the Beatles did this thing that was so crazy. The Beatles start out with I Want to Hold Your Hand.
Right.
And they end up with Revolution Number 9. Are you kidding me?
In a short period of time, their evolution, like some people, it might take them 30 years to get from one of those to the other. And they do it in what, 8 or 9 years? Always moving forward.
And the ability, again, the letting go of what it was. Letting go of what it was. And, you know, and one other thing that we forget is that all the people that did all this stuff, you know, they were really young. They were really young, and they were actually building the times. They were creating the times that they were in.
Right.
Like they were using the height of technology in terms of recording. That's what was happening with the Beach Boys and Pet Sounds.
Yeah.
And they were competing with each other. You know, there was a lot
better.
Of competition.
To be better. Motown, yeah.
You know, like Philly was competing with Detroit. And Detroit was competing with Chicago, right? It's like you have, you know, Marvin Gaye is out of Detroit and, you know, Curtis Mayfield's out of Chicago. You know what I mean? And so Otis Redding is out of Memphis, right? So these incredible artists, and Al Green out of Memphis and whatnot. So all these artists on their various labels, they're all compete. That's the other thing that we forget. It's all this wonderful music, but they're trying to cut each other. They're competing.
Right.
It's capitalism, right?
And
we're the consumer is the beneficiary of all of this really kind of cutthroat competition. Yeah. Like James Brown and Joe Tex were not friends. You know what I mean? They were trying to get to the number one slot.
Yeah.
And
we benefited from their genius.
Yeah. And we benefited from their genius and their bad blood. In a lot of cases, their bad blood.
Let me ask you this. So your guitar playing, Jimi Hendrix, when he starts, he doesn't know he's going to eventually someday be an innovator. He's just doing what comes naturally to him.
Yes.
But when you have all these amazing guitarists that came before you, how do you insert yourself in there? How do you not copy what other people do? How are you able to? I mean, the guitar only has 6 strings. It's amazing to me.
Yeah, now they're 8 strings and 12 strings.
But it's amazing to me.
7 strings and 8 strings routinely now.
Because you do have your own sound.
That's one of the challenges.
Yeah.
Is I think for guitarists, for players, is is self-awareness, self-knowledge, finding things that are them. Finding yourself in life is the hardest thing. Because once something becomes an industry, right, and it's a repeatable, you know, like I refer oftentimes to the guitar industrial complex, right? There's a huge, it was a few people, a relative handful of people that were doing this thing. And people arguing about who's this and who's that. You know, I was on Twitter talking about Terry Kath from Chicago.
Yeah.
Kath was a phenomenal guitar player.
Amazing.
Phenomenal vocalist. And Terry Kath made Chicago. He made that band a raw, Chicago Transit Authority was a prog band.
Yeah.
They were a prog, you know, they were, and his untimely death, because they always had this tension between their pop sensibilities, their accessibility, and this raw rock edge. And Terry Kath was that. And once he passed, Chicago stopped being a rock band.
Yeah.
They just stopped.
Yep.
They became
a pop band. You know,
and that's how impactful a person can be. And Hendrix loved Terry Kath's playing because Terry Kath wasn't going to play like Hendrix. He didn't play like Hendrix at all. He played like himself.
Yeah.
And these are the things and the great challenge. And the great challenge now is that it's like a kind of badass guitar player factory. Right?
Yeah.
Like there's a lot of people that can play fast. There are a lot of people that can play, you know, like what Hendrix did in 68. Eddie Van Halen, we just lost him in 2020. Eddie Van Halen reinvents the guitar in 78.
Yeah.
And he, again, he managed him, his brother, Michael Anthony, David Lee Roth, and then Sammy Hagar. They managed to I refer to Eddie Van Halen as the people's virtuoso. He's just a virtuosic, but he just had this charm. He had this boyish charm. He always looked happy.
Yeah.
When he was playing the guitar, he always looked happy. He very rarely looked, you know, I mean, he was a very serious musician, but he always looked like he was having the best time.
Yeah.
And
big smile.
And that combination with David Lee Roth and his insouciance and his, you know, that combination was just magical. And if, strangely enough, the fans of Van Halen, you know, they also followed the fact that it was a soap opera, too. It was kind of a crazy soap opera over many years. But, you know, what he did was phenomenal. One of the guitarists that he loved was Alan Holdsworth. And Alan Holdsworth is, like, among guitarists, he's, like, a guitarist.
I know the name, but not his music.
Tony Williams, oh, man. To check out the record Believe It by Tony Williams. It's like, you know, like he used to play with the band Soft Machine as well. And Eddie revered Alan Holdsworth. So he had, you know, as he's at the top of mind, he's looking at somebody else going, that guy's original. You know, the other person that loved Alan Holdsworth was George Benson. George Benson's another one. Phenomenal. Ridiculous. And singing his ass off. You know, so the thing about it is there are many ways to be great in guitar. You don't have to be... Like the idea, like everybody has to shred. You know, Mark Knopfler doesn't do that. He does a whole other thing.
Yeah.
Steve Ray Vaughan, he transcended. You know, obviously you hear Albert King and Jimi Hendrix, but he transcends his influences. Even though you hear his influences, the genius of Steve Ray Vaughan is that he is himself, even though you can hear it. You know, like Robin Trower, very influenced by Hendrix, but you know, he made his own original music coming out of Procol Harum. So there's like the thing, the challenge is for players. There's a band called Thank You Scientist, heavy prog, and there's a guitar player named Tom Mondo. Ridiculous. You know, and there's so many people that I see coming up, my friend Ben Tyree, great jazz rock guitar player, Malcolm Brickhouse from Unlocking the Truth. And the key is to know yourself and be yourself. And also to find things, I would say, find something to play that nobody else would even want to play. And that's you. Like,
nice.
Stop trying to fix your playing to be like somebody else.
I like that you're not complacent, that you're still listening to new music and new guitarists, and you're just not in your own bubble. You're always looking for other stuff. That's cool.
Well, you know, there's always somebody that's going to kick your ass. I mean, there's somebody, you know, it's just like, holy shit, you know?
Right.
Like one of my, you know...
like a boxer.
I think about Greg Howe. Greg Howe, you know, he started out as a shreddy guy, and he's just become this phenomenal jazz rock player. We had a, you know, we were playing in the South, and there was a band, the Alan Scott Band. This dude was ridiculous. This guitar player was ridiculous. You know, and so, and I love it, you know what I mean? And at the same time, you know, in my own work, there's a challenge, you know, okay, going further into what I'm trying to say and articulate it and get closer. There's always an opportunity. Like somebody asked me, well, don't you get bored playing a particular song? It's like every time I start the minor blues of Middleman, you know, right, you know, there's always a chance that I'm going to play something I hadn't played before.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Because there's two schools, really. There's the improvising school and there's the constructivist school. Like if you hear like Deep Purple Highway Star, that, you know, that Ritchie Blackmore solo is iconic. It's always, that's the solo. And anyone that's playing Highway Star has to learn
has
that
to play
solo.
That
it's
solo,
like,
yeah.
It's like classical music. But I come from a completely an improvisational kind of background, you know? I mean, mm-hmm. That's the thing, you know, that's like hearing Pete Cozy with Miles and, you know, Mike Stern with Miles and, you know, and hearing John McLaughlin with Miles and everybody with Miles. And, you know, hearing Jimi Hendrix would never, you know, like there are, what, 7 or 8 or 9 or 10 different versions of Red House. Red House is always different. Always different. And that's the thing for me.
When you're playing live with Living Color, how much room in a live show do you have to just all of a sudden go off? Would the band just follow you? How's that go?
We play the tunes. I mean, sometimes I'll play like an introduction to a song like Desperate People. But, you know, generally, my solos are inside the tunes. But
yeah.
I'm trying to find something new to play. Like when I play Cult, I've never tried to play the Cult solo exactly. So, I mean, there's a couple of phrases that I'll play, but generally I improvise it.
All right, cool.
You know what I mean? So pretty much what I do.
Couple more questions for you. You guys started as a New York band. So after Vivid came out, when did you realize that you made it? Was it stuff like when you were on Saturday Night Live or Showtime at the Apollo or David Letterman show? When you guys were doing all those appearances with the first album, were you able to step back and go, I think we've made it?
You know what? When it happened, when I actually started to hear our music on the radio, right? When I heard, you know, like, that's the first song I heard on the radio was in Florida. We were in the middle of the night, and this station played Middleman. You know, it you didn't hear it all that much on the radio. But Cult of Personality, once MMR in Philadelphia broke the song, and the song was really starting to get steam, and then we made the video, and
yeah,
then it blew up. But you know, I think at one point, one of our managers said, "Oh, you sold 100,000 records this week," and it was such. I couldn't wrap my mind around the abstraction.
Yeah.
And I couldn't wrap my mind around.
Yeah, numbers numbers make you think. You're like, what, huh? What, in a week?
How's that? What? But, you know, for me, it was just very special. It was a special time, and it was a time that I don't know, man. It was weird. It was a weird. I think of it like I was a dude, you know, playing guitar in the basement, you know, and suddenly I remember hearing Black Magic Woman, the first time I heard Black Magic Woman. And then we were playing at the Stone in San Francisco, and my manager was trying to get my attention. He was really annoying me, and I turned, and Carlos Santana was standing there on the side of the stage.
Wow.
And that's the moment. That's the moment. That's the moment. That's it. When I turned and saw Carlos Santana standing on the side of the stage at a Living Color gig, that's the moment.
And I'm sure he wasn't just standing there. He was probably into it.
I call him my sensei, still my hero.
And, nice.
That's it. You know, I mean, and again, you know, playing with Jack Bruce, touring with Jack Bruce, you know, having tea with Robert Fripp, so I turn around and go, like, I don't even know what to say or think about that type of stuff. You know,
that's cool. It's fun to meet your heroes.
Yeah, and actually, you know, I've only had like one really bad meeting with someone I looked up to.
Those happen too.
Yeah, but you know, I got to meet some of the greatest cats. You know, meeting Ernie Isley. Ernie Isley was on, you know, like, who's that lady? I mean, holy shit. So many of the people that I hold in high regard.
Yeah.
And it's very powerful. And that's the thing. Like, what the ups and downs of the music industry, those happen. But I tell you, I feel incredibly fortunate. Incredibly fortunate. It doesn't escape me at all. And I don't take it for granted.
That's good. And you're still here. And I mean, you guys released your last album, Shade, just 3 years ago. Is there more Living Color down the road?
We're processing the current insanity. You know, figure out like how to even talk about the last 4 years. It's like, oh, wow.
You got to put pen to paper.
I know.
Vernon, go ahead.
Yeah, some things. Definitely. There's a lot to. You know what? We're going to be dealing with this for a long time. Like, there isn't, right now what's strange to me is there isn't any music, or there's barely any music, because Alicia Keys put out something, that song Good Job, which was real, very cool.
You're the engine that makes all things go, and you're always in disguise, my hero. I see your light in the dark, smile in my face when we all know it's hard. There's no way to ever pay you back. Bless your heart, no, I love you for that. Honest and selfless, don't know if this helps it, but good job. You're doing a good job, a good job. You're doing a good job, don't get too down. The world needs you now. Know that you matter, 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 yeah. You're doing a good job, a good job.
But I haven't heard anything to even attempt to deal with the amount of loss we've had.
Yeah.
It's enormous. It's enormous. And we don't know how to react. We don't know. I mean, we don't know. We haven't publicly grieved. I mean, it's insane. And it's still happening.
It's every day. It's happening right now.
Every day. And that's something, you know, and there's going to have to be some heartbreaking music. Like all of us that do this, that write songs, that even think about this,
It'll be unavoidable. There's no way that you won't be able to write something about it.
But we are avoiding it. But it's unavoidable, but we are avoiding it.
Currently, yes.
We are avoiding it. And you know what? There's a great, on Springsteen's latest record.
Yeah,
there's the song, Rainmaker.
Rainmaker.
Rainmaker says white's black and black's white. Says night's day and day's night. Just close your eyes and go to sleep now. I'm in a burning field and loading buckshot in the low clouds. Rainmaker, a little faith for hire. Rainmaker, the house is on fire. Rainmaker, take everything you have. Sometimes folks, they believe in something so bad, so bad.
Yes.
Rainmaker is my jam. That tune is it.
Yeah, that's the one.
That's for me, that's my favorite on the whole, right? Rainmaker, though, is it's an incredible piece of music. I love it.
Yeah, so there's the one for now that we have, but we'll have more.
We need much more.
Yeah.
We need much more, you know.
Well, Vernon, I told you we were going to talk for 45 minutes. We've been talking for an hour and 20 minutes. But I have to be honest with you. I could talk to you for 3 more hours. This has been
a great
conversation. Well, this has been a great conversation.
Well, thank you. I've really enjoyed it.
Thank you. I enjoyed this too. This is going to put you on the spot. I usually use a playout song for the episode. What Living Color or Vernon Reed solo track would you like me to play as our playout song?
Oh, my goodness.
I know. It's tough.
You know, I would like this, you know. Solace of You.
Solace of You.
Solace of You.
You got it.
Solace of You from Time's Up. Absolutely.
And that's, I just want to tell people that they can follow you on Twitter. You're at VURNT22 or at Living Color. And the website's livingcolor.com. I can't wait to hear what you guys do next. Stay safe and healthy and well. And hopefully the next time you guys are through L.A., I'm going to contact you.
Hopefully we get to meet
in person.
Absolutely. All also, right. Burnt22 is my Instagram.
Oh,
and
okay, good.
I'm also a photographer, and I'm very proud of the pictures I do there. So,
and you're active on Twitter, and you answer people when they tweet at you, and that's nice.
Yeah, cause I like it because some people are very funny. They're very witty. Right. Some of the things are really, because I'm a geek and you know, like talking about things like The Mandalorian and Star Wars. Right. So recently there's a whole thing about Rogue One. Like Rogue One is the most, is like outside of The Empire Strikes Back, like Rogue One, it was such a necessary component of the Star Wars mythology, because it's a war movie, and it's a movie where there is complete sacrifice, and you can't throw something like war into your franchise and not deal with the reality. And it's the one film that deals with the reality of that word. So that, and The Mandalorian is just so, it's, this season is blowing my mind. So a lot of us geek out about that.
Right.
We geek out about guitars We geek out about stuff. You know, it's all different stuff, and I really enjoy it. My Twitter followers are really funny, really smart people.
Excellent.
And I enjoy it.
Well, again, thank you so much, Vernon. I can't wait to hear what you guys do next and what you do next. And that's it. We're done.
Yep. Working on the solo record, so that's happening too.
All right.
So something. Pat, it's been a real pleasure, bro, and I really enjoyed it.
Thank you, dude. See you soon.
All right, man.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Gotta go inside, back to the beginning.